This is Writer's Voice. We talk to writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Welcome to the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
And for the next 15 years, he's engaged in hand-to-hand, next 20 years, he's engaged in hand-to-hand combat with these folks to try to create an alternative culture in that union. Instead of it being a kind of hawkish culture, he's trying to create a more peace-oriented, anti-corporate, pro-worker union culture. And he actually succeeds in doing it.
That's biographer Les Leopold, author of The Man Who Hated Work and Loved Labor, The Life and Times of Tony Mazzacchi. We spend most of the hour with him. And we'll round out the show speaking with poet and children's book author Richard Michelson about his new book, Tuttle's Red Barn. Stay tuned. Tony Mazzacchi was probably the greatest American you've never heard of. From his earliest years in the 1950s as a union organizer in the Helena Rubinstein factory, Mazzacchi acutely felt the contradiction between capitalism and nature. Nature as in the natural environment and the natural need of all people for meaningful work. A longtime leader of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union, or OCAW, he created the early coalition between the two environmental movements, the one that deals with hazards in the workplace and the one that deals with hazards outside of it. As legislative director of the OCAW, he used his position as a fulcrum to lever the Occupational Safety and Health Act and the Clean Air Act into law. But he was more. Always a visionary, Tony founded the Labor Party to bring political power back to working people. And he was working closely with Kerr McGee worker Karen Silkwood when she died. In fact, many people think she was murdered for her work with Tony Mazzacchi and the OCAW. A movie was made of her story, starring Meryl Streep. Drawing on the student movement of the 1960s and 70s, Tony Mazzacchi created a cadre of dedicated health and safety activists and labor activists, of whom both I and my guest today were part. Tony tapped me right out of graduate school in economics to do a research project on worker health and safety programs. That project led to long-term federal funding to support community and labor workplace health coalitions, known as COSH groups. I worked for years on the COSH movement. But I also did a stint in another Tony Mazzacchi-inspired organization, the Labor Center, headed by my guest this hour, Les Leopold. He's written a fascinating and gripping biography of his friend Tony Mazzacchi. It's called The Man Who Hated Work and Loved Labor. Well, Les Leopold, welcome to Writer's Voice. Now, your book, The Man Who Hated Work and Loved Labor, why this title?
Well, Tony had a healthy disrespect for work. In 1948, after he came out of the war, he worked for about 6 months at the Ford Motor Company over in New Jersey, and he worked on an assembly line, and it was so hard and so horrific that his respect for working people and what they had to go through went up dramatically. But he realized that traditional work, production work, work in hierarchical situations was not a fantastic thing. Later on, as he was a union official, he got involved in occupational safety and health, and he realized not only was the work drudgery, but it was incredibly dangerous, and many, many people were dying before their time. And he just thought that the left in particular romanticized work. And his famous line was, you know, work is crap, that's why I became a union bureaucrat. Yet he had this incredible passion for the labor movement, for working people, and that's why the title was put together.
Now, I've already told our listeners that I knew and I worked with Tony Mazzacchi, and throughout the years, the decades, that I frankly thought he was one of the greatest Americans, most people never heard of him. But that really never bothered him. Could you talk about, you know, what he was, what he saw his role as, and why also, finally, have so few people known about him?
That's a very, very interesting question, and I've been pondering it for quite a while now. I think he was a pure organizer. He saw himself, he grew up in an era where being a CIO organizer was a high calling. If you were like a UAW organizer or a steelworkers organizer, that was like a high calling.
And tell us what the CIO was.
Congress and Industrial Organization that split off from the, Committee for Industrial Organization that split off from the AFL-CIO, in 1937, I believe it was, and it led to this massive organizing of industrial workers. And the unions that grew up then, like the United Automobile Workers, to be involved in this upsurge of labor in the 30s and 40s, it was really like being a top executive today for many, many people. And being an organizer was like a calling. And in Tony's mind, it was supposed to be done in a very selfless way. It wasn't that you didn't lead, but you didn't, as he put it, blow your own horn. I have one incredible story that epitomizes this. He blew open the lid on the asbestos scene, starting with this burial of Tyler, Texas asbestos plant, where at least 1,000 workers were severely poisoned, and I'm sure almost all of them died before their time due to the asbestos exposure. Paul Brodeur from The New Yorker wrote a award-winning book that traced, basically was a story of Tony Mazzocchi and the health and safety movement, and it was published in 1973-74, and I found this ad that was placed in the New York Times, and it was a full-page, blank page of The New Yorker, and it had one incredible quote in the middle, and it was this passionate Tony Mazzocchi quote about health, occupational safety and health and how it was murder in the workplace, and it was in huge, bold letters, and then at the bottom of the page it said, from a series by Paul Brodeur, Annals in the Workplace, etc., in The New Yorker. Well, I looked at this thing and I said, this is fantastic. And I remember Tony handed this to me when I first came to work with him as an intern in 1970, summer of 74. And I looked at it and looked at it, and I realized Tony's name was not on the ad. They lifted his quote and didn't use his name. And you know what? I cannot find any person that he ever complained to about this, because he thought it was so fantastic that this series was out there and the whole world was going to know about the occupational health and safety movement, that he didn't feel even the remote bit slighted. So to me, that was like the epitome of the pure organizer. And I think that's one of the reasons he wasn't as well known. Unlike many other labor officials or stars, he was not out to promote himself. He was out to promote a movement. It was just an amazing trait. I've never seen another labor person or any other person that had an ego that strong that he didn't need to stroke it all the time.
Yeah, and it was an ego that was really fully in the service of not just one movement, but really of the marriage of two movements, that is the labor and the environmental movement.
Actually, several movements. He thought he was going to have, he was hoping to bring together the peace movement, the environmental movement, the labor movement, and the women's movement. He hoped they would all come together at some point in the 70s and 80s to be a strong anti-corporate popular movement.
Well, say more about that. What is the connection between those four movements and his larger vision?
Well, from where he sat, he saw a rising corporate power in America that was just detrimental to sort of the most fundamental values that we hold. And it was going to be detrimental to health. He saw a connection between rising productivity and the cancer epidemic. He was certain that that exposures at the workplace was dramatically increasing the amount of cancer in society, and certainly amongst working people, but also amongst those who lived around facilities, and that many of them were lower income people. He saw that this was a tragedy in the making, and that the only way to do this was to basically tame corporate power, which you could not do. No one movement alone could do it. He saw the rise of the environmental movement, the labor movement, occupational safety and health, women, civil rights movement, peace movement, as all challenging corporate prerogatives. And at some point, he hoped they would share a common analysis and actually bring serious reforms into place. He was convinced that this was possible. Later on in life, he realized it was going to take a lot longer, but he was hoping that he could redirect the energy of the 60s into that kind of movement for the 70s. And some people would say he came damn close.
Tell us about where Tony came from. Talk about his origins, about his family, how that helped to feed his involvement in the labor movement, how that grew him as an organizer.
He came from a Italian immigrant family in Brooklyn. His dad was a tailor, a skilled tailor, who was had to learn English didn't have much of an education in Italy, but was literate, got involved in the Amalgamated Clothing Workers Union, and became a kind of a low-level operative, a shop steward and someone who helped the union on election day, and, you know, was a serious unionist. In 1930, roughly, his dad got blacklisted for a while because he helped out in a strike, and his mom, Tony's mom, died of cancer when he was four, and the dad couldn't make the payments on their house, and they ended up all moving in with grandma and the aunts and uncles, and that became the cauldron, I think, that shaped a lot of Tony's life. It was a big house with, you know, 12, 13, 14 people, boarders. There were all kinds of points of view. His dad was sort of a progressive Roosevelt Democrat. There was an uncle who was gay, closet gay, who was in the Communist Party. There was a brother-in-law who was Lindbergh, American First, you know, almost semi-Nazi. It was all going on. It was in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, which was a very strong Italian pro-Mussolini neighborhood. And Tony thrived in this extended family where every night at the dinner table there'd be these arguments. And this little, I interviewed some of the relatives that were still alive at the time, and they said, you know, this little kid was sitting at the table, and he was the only kid in the family that, like, participated with the adults in these debates and conversations. They'd listen to the radio, listen to Roosevelt, Father Coughlin, you know, the right-wing radio priest. He just got into the issues of the day. And two things happened. One is he developed a very strong sense that he wanted to be involved in the trade union movement. The other was he developed this incredible ability to get along with people very different from himself politically. On the streets of Brooklyn, he was like a natural leader. He wasn't big. The big kids protected him, you know, in fights and stuff, but they just loved, he was a good storyteller. They liked being around him, and he just knew people gravitated towards him, and he liked all kinds of people. He was very comfortable in social situations, and that's kind of the way he organized for the rest of his life.
And we're talking about the life and times of Tony Mazzocchi with Les Leopold. The book is The Man Who Hated Work and Loved Labor. You know, he was an incredibly ebullient personality, a really large-sized personality. And as I was reading your book, memories of Tony came flooding back to me, most notably his voice. And I'd like to play a little clip for you of an interview that he gave to Terry Gross on Fresh Air, just a very brief clip. It shows the richness of his accent, but he also says something that I'd like you to comment on. So hold on for a second, and I'll cue that up.
We want to become a movement again. The only gains that people have made in this nation, working people, have been through movements, civil rights movement, the labor movement, the environmental movement. Legislation has only been a reaction to the existence of these movements. What this effort is all about is the recreation of a new movement and the rejuvenation of a culture that once existed, a working class culture in this country.
So now he's talking there, actually he's talking about something that he became very involved in, the creation of a labor party later on. He talks there about a working class culture. Say something about what does he mean by that, and how did his life express that?
It takes us back to really his what he saw in the streets of Brooklyn and what he saw when he was in the war. He enlisted, lied about his age, got into the armed forces when he was 16, and ended up in the Battle of Bulge, and also was at the liberation of Buchenwald about 2 weeks after it was liberated. He got to see the death camps, and it really shook him. Also, he saw a race war take place at Camp Stewart in Georgia, you know, where black and white soldiers were fighting over segregation. I mean, he saw the ugly side of what can happen to working people, and he was determined to not see that happen again. His life was built around building a positive culture for working people, one based on struggle, solidarity, that would be the antidote for the Mussolini negative side of what working people and all people are capable of. So what he saw was a culture of solidarity on the streets of Brooklyn. There were so many people in trade unions and so many families wrapped up in trade unions that, you know, you didn't cross the picket line. As he used to put it, you cross the picket line, you didn't go home. I mean, the whole neighborhood would know about it. There's just no way you could go home. And he wanted to recreate that kind of sense of a movement that could empower itself and actually make life better for people, you know, in the neighborhood, in the city, in the country, and that it would feed on itself in a positive direction. Because he feared if that kind of movement was not created, the other kind of, you know, xenophobic, anti-immigrant, you know, flag-waving movements, that they would be created in the place of what he saw as a positive progressive movement. If the vacuum wouldn't be filled by something positive, then something negative sooner or later would come up, because people hungered for that kind of solidarity, and they were going to do something about their situation.
And for that kind of connection.
Yep.
So now bring us, he comes back from the war, and he has to get a job, although actually he trained first as a dental technician, is that correct?
Yeah. He learned how to make teeth for 2 years. He actually was a serious student. Went to dental school on the GI Bill of Rights. The tuition actually cost more than Harvard at the time. But it was just a holding pen until he could get himself into the trade union movement. And he eventually ended up at the Helena Rubinstein plant, which at the time was in Long Island City, May 1st, 1950. Got a job there. Within a few years, he kind of worked his way up and became a chief steward and then president. And it was mostly a local of female workers, and he built it into this fighting machine. He got involved, and he got the local involved in the anti-nuclear testing movement, and he became the first labor person involved in that and in the founding of the Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy. And along the way, he asked his members to collect teeth, baby teeth, from their children and grandchildren, which were sent to Barry Commoner, which was part of this effort to see if radioactivity was showing up in children's bones, in their teeth, strontium-90, after a nuclear test.
And Barry Commoner, of course, is the writer who's written very... Barry Commoner, would you call him an environmentalist?
Well, in many ways, I think he was one of the founders of what we would call the environmental movement today. And there's a very interesting parallel between Commoner and Mazzocchi. They didn't really know each other till later on in the 60s. But in the 50s, both in their respective fields were trying to do something about the kind of craziness of the arms race. And both of them were kind of looking for a way to impact the mainstream without getting red-baited. And Commoner did it by setting up this scientific public information movement, which Rachel Carson said helped influence her to get involved in the writing of Silent Spring, which was that scientists shouldn't be making policy, but should be informing the public about the scientific facts of situations so that the public can make informed decisions. Well, of course, once the public knew about what was going on in the environment, they got aroused. And Tony saw this as a brilliant way to start building a movement. And when he got involved in occupational safety and health, he did the same thing. He started to have scientists and working people inform the public and workers about what was going on, the toxic exposures that were going on in plants, and that really got people worked up. So over time, the environmental commoners thing laid the basis for the modern environmental movement, and then Tony sort of hooked the occupational safety and health effort into that movement. And he actually never called it occupational safety and health. He called it hazards in the workplace environment, because he was trying to consciously put those two movements together.
Now, going back to his work at Helena Rubinstein, of course he was working with a whole lot of chemicals there, but you also devote a lot of time to a fascinating discussion of the post-war years in labor, that is the immediate post-war years, where there was a real shift from what had been left-leaning unions to business unionism. And this was a shift that Tony Mazzocchi was able to survive, unlike a lot of other left-leaning unionists.
Well, that's true. I mean, one of the fascinating things that I sort of got a feel for in working on this book was that McCarthyism actually started long before Senator McCarthy came on the scene. The trade union movement was purging itself from about from 1940 in 1948 already. You know, Senator McCarthy wasn't even around, and in certain unions, it was incredibly debilitating. In the union Tony entered, Gas, Coke, and Chemical Workers Union, it was decimated by these purges and attacks on each other. And the local Tony had entered, the key organizers and leaders that had put it together, who were probably communists, all had been wiped out. But Tony survived and didn't get red-baited because he really bonded with his membership. He never believed... The thing that he thought ruined the left in America was its subservience to the Soviet Union. I mean, he didn't really know what to think about the Soviet Union at the time because there was, you know, such hysteria going on that, you know, some things sounded true, some things didn't sound true. He kept an open mind about it. But he wasn't going to let his trade union work be run by a foreign policy agenda. And the CP, was Communist Party, was doing this nonstop, and they were basically ostracizing themselves from the mainstream of the trade union movement. Tony had a sense of where his workers were at, and he deliberately, step by step, educated them about how corporations worked and how the movement worked and what its history was. And he did it in such a grassroots, homespun way that there was no way anybody was going to say, oh, this is communism, this is bad, we should get rid of this guy. They really respected what he did, and he fought for their concrete gains in the here and now while he was doing this long-term education. And the other thing he did was he consciously went about capturing the entire social life of working people. They had bowling leagues and blood drives, and they had so many events going on in this local union that the company had to cancel their own bowling league because the white-collar workers wanted to go hang out with the blue-collar workers in their bowling league. It was such a hot place to hang out. And he just had, he had book clubs and newspapers and dances, and they just went on and on and on, and it created a social life to the point where this one worker who was hired the same day as Tony told me, the supervisors used to tell the workers to stop talking so much about politics on the shop floor. Because the workers were so engaged in this other life, their minds were free from the drudgery of the Helena Rubinstein assembly line. And that sort of freedom to debate, discuss other ideas really became the culture of that workplace.
Well, let's move on now to his work with the OCAW, the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union. How did this come about, and how did it change the kind of work that he did?
Well, his union, Gas, Coke, and Chemical Workers Union, had been so decimated by these purges, anti-communist purges, that eventually it had to merge with another union. It merged with the oil workers, formed the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers. So Tony woke up one day, basically, and he found himself in a union that was totally tied up with the national security state. Not only did it have oil workers who were instrumental in foreign policy, because oil workers internationally were in key geopolitical situations. I mean, you know, who controlled Middle East oil was mattered a great deal, Venezuelan oil. And the Oil Workers Union was used by the CIA, and this is well documented, as a conduit. And there were atomic workers, and these were not civilian atomic plants. These were people who made nuclear weapons, made bombs. That's what they did every day. So Tony, this basically fundamentally anti-war, anti-nuclear weapons activist, was in a union that made atomic weapons and was riddled with CIA operatives. So that kind of changed the context of his organizing. But it's interesting, he still didn't back down. He got elected to the National Executive Board, and the book, I think, goes through some amazing stories about how that all happened. But he makes it to this National Executive Board. And in the first convention he goes to, he puts on an educational on the hazards of atomic weapon production. And it's one of the first kind of environmental health and safety things he does. And he does it right in front of these union officials who just hate groups like Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy and view it as a threat to their livelihood. And they're Cold War hawks. And for the next 15 years, he's engaged in hand-to-hand, next 20 years, he's engaged in hand-to-hand combat with these folks to try to create an alternative culture in that union. Instead of it being a kind of hawkish culture, he's trying to create a more peace-oriented, anti-corporate, pro-worker union culture. And he actually succeeds in doing it. By the time he makes it to high office in the union, the oil, chemical, and atomic workers are known as one of the most progressive unions in the country. And I find that remarkable, given that during that same period, on two different occasions, there were huge exposés in the New York Times and elsewhere about how its foreign policy operations were completely run by the CIA. Tony Blue helped blow the lid on that, helped move some of those people out of office. Eventually, he actually loses his run for the presidency, not once but twice, by a narrow, narrow margin, to a person I think actually was a CIA agent. Really, had he been in any other union, he would have become a household word.
And we're talking with Les Leopold about his terrific biography about Tony Mazzocchi, the man who hated work and loved labor. Let's talk more about how Tony did build this occupational safety and health movement, or as you say, the movement against hazards in the workplace. He really was the father of this movement and one of the most, probably the most celebrated example or case that he was involved in was the Karen Silkwood case. A movie was based on it, starring Meryl Streep. Silkwood was killed in a car crash. Tell us about this case and tell us about Tony's involvement with it.
The Karen Silkwood story is really a story about trying to save the union in a very small facility in the middle of a right-to-work state in Oklahoma where people didn't have to join a union. The majority did. And Karen Silkwood was a member of a small oil, chemical, and atomic workers local union at the Kerr McGee facility in Cimarron, Oklahoma. Kerr McGee was the largest private sector uranium producer, and they had had a vicious strike at Karen Silkwood's plant a couple years earlier. At one point, there were 120 out of 150 people in the union. After this disastrous strike, which the company forced, they were down to 20 people. And the next step was what they called the certification. They were going to get force the workers to, or encourage the workers to vote on getting rid of the union entirely. They just didn't want a union there. And what they had going on there was that they were making plutonium rods for a new technology called the fast breeder reactor. It was supposed to make more atomic fuel than it used. So it would produce an endless supply of plutonium, great for weapons and supposedly great for civilian power. We'd have energy too cheap to meter. That was the idea. And Kerr McGee wanted to be right in the middle of it. So they were producing these plutonium rods. But the conditions at the plant were horrific. The turnover rate, now catch this, 60% of the workforce left every year. Alarms went off all the time. People were being exposed. Nobody was told how dangerous plutonium really was, that it was the most dangerous substance that we've ever come across. It was just a horrendous situation. So when they came in and they told Tony what was going on there, he sort of rolled his eyes and to himself, more or less, and he said, forget it. You know, this is not going to, they're going to lose. Sure, I'll take them over to the Atomic Energy Commission, but there's going to be a decert election and they're going to lose. But then, just as Tony was sort of giving up on them, later after that meeting, Karen Silkwood kind of drifted into his office and said, I want to tell you something. They are cheating on their quality control tests. That some of these rods that are coming out have cracks in them. And when they take x-rays in quality control, and she worked in the quality control department, they're doctoring the x-rays. They're taking a magic marker out where the little line is, and they're coloring it in. And Tony's eyes lit up on that one. He said, if you can give me the evidence for that, I think I have a strategy that can win this situation. And the strategy was pretty simple. He would get that evidence to his friend at the New York Times, David Burnham. He thought it would be a front page story because there was such a controversy over this fast breeder reactor because it's a very, very dangerous process. And safety studies had shown that had been buried by the Atomic Energy Commission, shown that a mishap could lead to, you know, 200,000 people dying, contaminating an area the size of Pennsylvania. So there was a lot of controversy brewing over this technology. So the next step was to deliver these documents to the New York Times. Well, just as she was about to make the connection to give the stuff to the Times, she gets exposed badly, and they don't know what the source is. She walks into the plant, all the alarms go off, and they scrub her down, just like in the movie Silkwood. She goes home, she walks into the plant the next day, it's worse. So they figure it's coming from her house, they rip her house apart. And in retrospect, Tony figures what they were doing was they're looking for these documents, and this was their excuse. They tore the house apart, people, you know, full suits, white suits, Geiger counters, ripping up boards, taking all her stuff, reading her diaries, everything. Well, Tony has her sent to Los Alamos to have a full body test to see how badly exposed she was. She was pretty badly exposed. She flies back from Los Alamos, goes to the union meetings. She leaves, hops in a car, and heads on her way to where she's going to meet with David Burnham in the New York Times. She never gets there. After a couple hours, she's late. They call around. They can't find her, and someone tells she was in a terrible crash and dead on arrival at the hospital. They quickly go out to the scene where the crash took place. They're looking around. No, there's no signs of any papers. They find Burnham. He suggests that they get the car and get a private investigator to look at it. The OCAW hired this guy named Pipkin, and he testifies that he believes the car was hit. There was a dent in the car that could only have been made by being hit by another car. It wasn't made by towing it away, and that he was certain that somebody had knocked her off the road.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Les Leopold about his biography, The Man Who Hated Work and Loved Labor, The Life and Times of Tony Mazzocchi. Mazzocchi died of pancreatic cancer in 2002 at the age of 76. Stay tuned for more of our interview with Leopold after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking about the great labor leader and father of the occupational safety and health movement in the United States, Tony Mazzocchi. We're talking with the author of a terrific biography of him, Les Leopold. His book, The Man Who Hated Work and Loved Labor, is out from Chelsea Green. Now, we don't have a whole lot of time left, and I'd like to talk a bit more about how he, in fact, did create this occupational safety and health movement. You mentioned before that he followed Barry Commoner's idea of bringing a whole lot of scientists together. He also met a young woman named Susan Daum, who wrote a book that had an incredible impact on many people's lives, including mine. In fact, it's what got me involved in the health and safety movement, and that is Work is Dangerous for Your Health. So tell us, how did he do this? How did he create this movement? And then how did he link it up with the environmental movement to create, finally, the OSHA Act?
Well, this actually is also another incredible story. When he started, he was, at the time, sort of the chief lobbyist for the oil, chemical, and atomic workers in Washington, D.C., and he was getting all these phone calls from workers who were complaining about what they called dust. That's what they call toxic exposure there, that nobody knew it was toxic. They said, we have all this dust in the plant. And it was the beginning of the environmental movement, and the Cuyahoga River caught fire in Ohio, and, you know, pollution was a big word. And Tony was paying attention to what these workers were saying, and he started to see a pattern, and he started to look around. There was no law. He thought there's got to be a law against this. There was no effective law. So he started to get involved in OSHA legislation. And it got stuck in committee, even with a Democratic Congress and a Democratic president in 1968. They couldn't get it out of committee. So Tony said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go to the union, get a mandate to take create a roadshow of very public workshops where workers come in and talk about their exposures and try to find some scientists and whatnot to talk to them about what the problems are. And we're going to create this huge documentation, very public, in the press, and then we're going to bring it to Congress. So he set up these 9 workshops around the country called Hazards in the Workplace Environment, and workers came in and testified. When you read these documents, it's unbelievable the kind of exposures people face. But what's even more unbelievable is that there were no scientists around to answer the questions. They basically said, we don't know. And it was very clear to Tony that he had to not only get the law passed, but he had to then create an occupational health and safety cadre of people who could help answer these questions with workers. What happened then is he made a deal kind of with the other lobbyists in Washington. He said, look, you guys lobby. I can't lobby. I got to take this show on the road. Maybe together we'll get OSHA passed. And sure enough, he piggybacked this public roadshow with concern for the environment. In fact, he ended up being the speaker at Earth Day because people saw what he was doing as part of the environmental movement. His argument was pollution starts inside the workplace. We produce it.
The first Earth Day?
Yeah, 1970. But he then, the act was passed, and he saw it directly as a result of bringing together the environmental movement and his very public hearings. He basically held hearings. He had the Today Show come in and film them, and it was very moving stuff, and it was all dumped, you know, brought him into Congress in a very public way. He saw this is the way you get things done. And because Nixon signed the bill into law that Lyndon Johnson, didn't sign. So he said, hey, it doesn't matter who's in. What matters is the movement you build in the streets. The next movement he built, though, was he said, I need people who understand this stuff. This is highly technical stuff. We need docs and technicians on the side of working people. So he consciously set up internships, and he had dozens of these struggles going on against corporation after corporation all over the place on different chemicals. And he was using the OSHA standard to get new regulations passed. And he basically, some people credit him with founding the modern occupational medical community. The discipline, actually founding a worker-oriented discipline of occupational medicine by putting all these people into play.
Yeah, and then the creation of OSHA itself. And he points out in his interview with Terry Gross that this, you know, a lot of people say, well, Nixon signed the OSHA legislation. But Tony pointed out that that would have never happened had this movement not existed.
Absolutely. Matter of fact, one of Nixon's, I think it was his Secretary of Labor, went to a steelworkers convention and said over his dead body would he ever agree to an OSHA legislation. And then like a year later, he was right there saying it was the greatest thing since sliced bread, because there was this, they had really mobilized both the trade union movement and the environmental movement and focused it on this bill. And Nixon couldn't stop it, so he just, he said, well, okay, I'm going with it. I'm going to take credit for this thing.
We'll talk a little bit more about this, because we now are in a time, well, perhaps it's beginning to change, but in the 1970s, when the environmental movement was really gaining steam, and so was the occupational safety and health movement, they worked together. There was real solidarity between them. People in the environmental movement supported strikes by oil workers, by chemical workers that were around health and safety. And then that all went bad. There actually came a time, you talk about the Toms River case. Maybe you could say something about that, when, in fact, workers turned against the environmental movement. And I certainly have seen times when the environmental movement couldn't care less about workers.
Well, there was always going to be a certain amount of, you know, distance, because the experience of working people who were in the factories and environmentalists who were not in the factories. But what Tony proved was that with the right framework and with leadership from the union side, you could bridge the gap, and with leadership from the environmental side. Tony reached out to these environmental organizations and asked them to participate and frame the issue so they thought it was in their interest to participate. But it took leadership. I believe the biggest hit that was taken was when Tony was knocked out of office in 1979, then again in 1981 by, you know, very small percentage of the vote. When he wasn't there to provide the leadership for the trade union movement, and when Reaganism hit, the trade union people stopped providing leadership on the environmental side. They sort of retreated. And in Toms River, New Jersey, this was a classic case where there were huge exposures found that were polluting the aquifer around this facility. And what had once been a progressive local union when Tony was in office, ended up basically having no leadership and then bad leadership, and they ended up marching against mothers, counter-march against mothers who were protesting conditions in the plant, and Greenpeace came in. And
those mothers were protesting the fact that their children had been exposed to carcinogens.
Exposed, yeah.
And in fact, in Toms River, there was
a rash of
children.
Right. So there were real. This was a real bad situation. And then the company screwed the workers anyway, shut the plant down.
Well, that's exactly, I think, the issue. I mean, I remember Tony talking about the blackmail of your jobs versus your life. This was something that really got played, in fact. I mean, there were plenty of plants that shut down, and they would claim, that they shut down because people had protested conditions. Is this blackmail real, or
sure
is it an
real
excuse?
I mean, it doesn't matter whether it's an excuse or not excuse. It's real. Like, you raise Toms River, they shut it down. But Tony, actually, this is where his thinking jumped, like, years ahead of everybody else. He saw the situation as one that required an alternative non-corporate solution, that you shouldn't be begging the corporation to keep the plant open. What he wanted was the corporations to pay into what at the time he called the super fund for workers, which then would provide full pay and benefits for them to do what he would call redefined work. He wanted Rutgers University to set up an alternative campus on the old Toms River polluted grounds, that it would be a university of reclamation where the workers and scientists together would study and work on how to best clean up that facility so they could basically do the best to reclaim the land so it wouldn't harm the environment and the citizens around that facility, and that the workers would get their full pay to get degrees, high school degrees, many of them, and maybe advanced degrees, and they participate in this massive cleanup project. That's where his head was at. That's what he thought should happen when plants shut down.
You know, I want to ask you something. There's so much richness in this book, and we haven't even really talked about his idea of the Labor Party. I think listeners are going to have to go to the book to read that, because it's also another fascinating treatment of his idea of how you really build a third party that's very different from the typical one that we have. Maybe you could say very briefly, if you can do it in a minute or two.
Okay. Tony was a realist in that he knew that you couldn't build a third party that could be a spoiler party. You could only build a third party based on working people, an alternative to two corporate-dominated parties, if you do it slowly and carefully over basically a generation. And his idea was to have a non-electoral party, basically an educational party at first, that would intervene only in situations where the Democrats and Republicans were totally hopeless, which is actually what's happening now in South Carolina. There's a Labor Party that's official in South Carolina. It's picking a few districts where the Democrats have totally given up. But Tony never wanted to be a spoiler party. That was suicide to him. So he had a long-term plan that he hoped would build an alternative to two parties dominated by corporations. His line was great. If the bosses have two parties, we should have one of our own.
Well, the book is really terrific and an incredible read, too. I mean, this is a gripping biography of one of the greatest Americans that few people know who he was, and that's Tony Mazzocchi. The book is called The Man Who Hated Work and Loved Labor, and thanks so much, Les Leopold, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you very much for the opportunity. It was my pleasure.
And the book is The Man Who Hated Work and Loved Labor by Les Leopold. And now, a change of pace. Since I'm sure some of you out there in Radio Land have some kids you still have to buy gifts for, here's an idea for a literary gift. It's the story of the oldest farm in America, told by my next guest, Richard Michelson. He's teamed up with illustrator Mary Azarian for his lovely new children's book, Tuttle's Red Barn. The pictures are gorgeous. Michelson is the author of several previous children's books like Across the Alley and Too Young for Yiddish that all take place in the same working-class urban setting where Michelson himself grew up. So when he was asked to write Tuttle's Red Barn, he wasn't sure he had the rural expertise to do so.
The more that I thought about the story, I started to realize that what was really important to me in this book We were dealing with 12 generations, and the way that knowledge was passed down from generation to generation, the way the family grew and changed over time, and the interrelationships in the families between the parents and the children, and how the next generation took over. And all of a sudden, I started to realize, well, that's kind of what I do. Many of my books, regardless of where they're set, are very involved with interpersonal relationships.
And intergenerational.
And intergenerational relationships. We've spoken earlier on this show, I believe, about Across the Alley, Happy Feet, Too Young for Yiddish, some of my earlier books. And so in that light, I realized, well, this is something I could take on and really try to focus on the relationships between the generations. I realized I would have to learn a little something about farming, but that's the research part, and that's the part that can be fun.
You know, it seems to me that you tell the story of a nation through the story of this family.
Well, thank you, because that's really what we try to do. This book is really the history of America, and the best way often to see a history is through the eyes of one family. Many things went on. We see the Underground Railroad very much became important to the family, that where they had a house that actually had a secret room that hid the slaves on their way to Canada and freedom.
And what generation was that?
And that was the seventh generation, Joseph Edward Tuttle. And we found that the generation later, the Tuttles actually had the very first cider mill in Dover and a greenhouse. And we saw the transition from an economy that was based totally on self-sufficiency. It moved to a barter economy. Actually, the Tuttles were the first family that tried to capitalize, in a sense. They started to sell their fruits and vegetables at a time long before most people were ready for that idea. It did not work out at first. But later on, we found a generation that moved away from the farms, and their children and grandchildren suddenly started coming back and appreciating homegrown food.
And in fact, the Red Barn of the title really makes its appearance as a Red Barn in that very late generation, even though it's a house that was built on the site of the original house.
It was the site of the original house, actually. I think by the third generation, we had 12 people living in that little red barn, which later generations found was even too small to keep some of the animals. So our sense of housing certainly has changed over time. And, you know, it's fascinating to me to learn the history of any place and see the ebbs and flows. In this case, how the economy grew and shrank, and yet these people had this great adherence and love of the land and stayed with this same farm during times of plenty and times when their neighbors were all packing up and leaving to a life that, as I think one of the generations says, they only have to work 7 days a week, 12 hours a day.
You're listening to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. And I'm talking with Richard Michelson. He's the author of Tuttle's Red Barn, The Story of America's Oldest Family Farm. It's illustrated by Mary Azarian, winner of the Caldecott Medal. Well, let's start at the beginning. Who was the first to come?
Well, the first to come was John Tuttle. He was actually the son of an English barrel maker. And his parents wanted, as the reason for many people to come to this country, a better life for him. And John, when he was just a young man, came over here all on his own.
What did he bring with him?
He brought with him a set of his pewter candle holders, which his mother gave him, and a single axe. In fact, he was on a ship that came from England and shipwrecked off the coast of Maine. All his other belongings were lost, but he did keep one thing from his mother and one thing that his father had given him.
And those are actually, he was able to survive with just those two, one for light and one to build whatever he needed.
He did.
And now how did he come, why did he come to Dover, New Hampshire?
He came to Dover because he got a land grant. The King Charles I at the time was giving parcels of land to young men, as it were, who were willing to go on an adventure, willing to farm the land. The idea was, of course, that they would send back, in the way of taxes, to England. In John's case, he would send beaver skins, which he traded the Indians for various fruits and vegetables. And this was the tax he would send back home.
Hmm. Now, you mentioned the Indians. There's a real kind of tragic, really, progression of relationships there. When we first meet them, there seems to be some friendship and then conflict and then disappearance. Could you say something about that?
Sure. I mean, I think this is a situation that went on all over the country, obviously. But the Penacook Indians, who were the original settlers in Dover when the first John showed up, actually helped many of the settlers. They taught them how to fertilize the soil with oysters. They helped them grow their vegetables in a climate that was very different from most of the England settlers. And there was trade between the Indians and the early settlers and friendship, if you could call it that. Certainly they were helping each other. As time went on and generations passed, what happened was the settlers started taking more and more land. They had a different view of the land than the Native Americans did.
How so?
Well, they believed that what they settled was theirs, where the Native Americans had a more communal sense of the land as something that was borrowed, used, but not particularly owned in a certain plot. And as the citizens of Dover started to spread out and take more and more of the land, eventually the Indians attacked and tried to burn down a good deal of the town. They succeeded in doing that. But it was a small victory, and in the end, the settlers continued to grow, continued to take over more and more land. And by the fifth generation,
The Revolutionary War.
We find young William Tuttle finding some old Indian arrowheads on his property and not even realizing, in fact, that Indians once lived there.
My guest is children's book author and poet Richard Michelson. We're talking about his book Tuttle's Red Barn, The Story of America's Oldest Family Farm. Well, why don't you read a couple of generations for us? You can either,
sure,
you know, they can be one to the next, or you can jump around as you like.
Why don't we start at the beginning? And John Tuttle, as I mentioned, was the first generation. He was born in 1616. The book starts out with a beautiful woodcut by Mary of the angel Gabriel, his ship on the ocean, coming across the ocean. And we begin with John Tuttle loved adventure, and he didn't mind hard work. "There's a new England across the ocean," he told his parents, "where land is plentiful and free." After 2 long months at sea, the weather worsened, and the ship anchored off the coast of Maine. Now John watched from shore as the storm battered the hull against the rocks. In his hands, he held all that remained of his possessions, his father's axe, and the 2 pewter candle holders his mother had given him after they'd hugged goodbye. John walked for 10 days until he found 20 cabins clustered between 2 rivers. This was Dover, the largest settlement in New Hampshire. With his neighbor's help, John cleared and plowed his land and built a small cabin. The thatched roof would keep the house warm in winter and cool in summer. John thought it would be the perfect place to raise a family. On the Sabbath, John would dress in his new high-tapered hat and fasten his breeches below his knees. One Sunday, on the way to the meeting house, he passed his neighbor's daughter, Dorothy. John daydreamed about her throughout the whole 3-hour sermon, and afterward he walked her home. John and Dorothy fell in love and married. They had 4 children and named their youngest boy John Jr.
That was Richard Michelson talking about and reading from Tuttle's Red Barn. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Don't miss us next week when we talk with Frances Moore LaPay about her new, short but pithy and inspiring book, Getting a Grip: Clarity, Creativity, and Courage in a World Gone Mad. And be ready to take a new look at some old ways of thinking. To find out more about our guests, past and future, go to our website, writersvoice.net. You can get our podcast there and tell us what you think about the show. Thanks to Michael Pollitt for assistance on this show. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.